But I do want to say stories are really powerful. They help us understand that our identities are rooted in something. We're not just floating around with a name. Our names are interesting. Our pasts are interesting, where we came from, things that we have no control over inform who we are. And we're going to get into a little bit about the voices that tell us who we are and how do we look for the biblical voices that tell us who we are and who does God say we are and what does that mean for us in this time as his witnesses, as his people of unity, as his people who are reconcilers. But before we get into that, let's just do a 5-minute break, stretch, touch your toes, do what you got to do, and then we'll get going again. One of the things that I love about hearing people's stories is that it really, really communicates things that have to do with identity, with people's hopes and dreams, with the opportunities that they have or the opportunities that they haven't had. And when you're able to really understand someone's story, you really just feel closer to them. I mean, I don't know how many of you people sitting in the groups there, maybe you weren't sure about who you were sitting with. But by the end, you were like, I like this person. I should get to know them a little more, right? I hope. Or maybe you were like, But stories are a really powerful way of understanding culture and understanding race and just understanding each other. And at the end, we'll get into a little bit of application. But I think the exercise of asking questions, if you're able to ask good questions, if you're able to ask clarifying questions, really helps to get into people's stories that help them feel loved, help them feel known. And that's a huge part of just, you know, the Christian experience as we grow in community. What I'd like to do now is I want to move on to kind of getting to the foundation of why race and culture matters and what the Bible has to say about it. There's a lot of voices out there right now trying to explain diversity, trying to explain racism, trying to explain privilege, trying to explain all these words. There's a lot of sparks flying. There's a lot of people upset. And I think one of the things we as the church can get better at is really understanding what does God say about race and culture. And I think when we start to do that, and the Bible has a lot to say about it, I know in my own experience when I came to know the Lord when I was 10 years old, and even as I grew, I never really saw some of the scriptures that we're going to even go over now in the way that I see them now. I think I've had a broader understanding of God's vision for his church, for his bride, that God is the God of not just my church, but all the churches. Not just my nation, but all the nations. That God cares about this world and he cares about all people. And we're going to take a look at Genesis 1. Let's start at the very beginning. It's a good place to start. And Genesis 1, 27 says, "So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them." This is the idea of the Imago Dei, that we are made in the image of God. Every human being is made in the image of God. Last week in Ephesians, during the service, I spoke about all of us being dead, all of us being dead in our transgressions and sin. So while we are dead and sinful, we are also made in the image of God. And culture reflects that, because culture is a grouping of people. People have values, people have expressions. And culture reflects both the Imago Dei and the depravity. Being able to identify the image of God, being able to see good things in cultures, not just our own, is a really, really big part of taking a step towards understanding others who are different than you. My son goes to Pinecrest here in East Lansing, and the other night we had a multicultural night. And it was really neat. We had all these in the gym. They set up these little tables, and there are lots of different countries represented. And then in the cafeteria, lots of families cooked all these different meals. And there was just foods from every country. It was pretty amazing. It was really, really neat. But then my son Judah is eating off his plate, and he's like, "This is weird. This doesn't taste right. This isn't good." And I realized this is what human beings do. We define good. We define right for what we think, for what we think is normal. It comes from our default. And that's one of the problems that I've seen grow in people as they experience cultures, as we've seen people do missions. Whenever they experience something that is not from their default, they tend to say, "This is wrong. This is weird. This is not good." It's just not good, right? It's not mac and cheese. It's not good, right? That's what my son would say. But I think when we begin to grow in understanding that every culture expresses itself in different ways, and there are good things that we see in different cultures, we begin to understand God is displayed in different cultures. I remember as I grew in my friendship with my friend Hang, who's from Vietnam, and he actually led worship at our wedding. Hang just has such a he has such a dependence on God. You know, Hang, who came over from Vietnam as a refugee kid at 12 years old, he just saw God in a different way. And God had revealed himself to Hang in a different way. And I think that is one of the blessings that we get. When we start to see other people's stories and other people's experiences, we start to appreciate God in his different tones, is what I like to call it. But we start to realize that God's church has a lot to contribute to our understanding of who God is. God has revealed himself, and people have experienced God in different ways. And I think as a multicultural church, you begin to see that, and you begin to experience that when you're able to break out of what you know is your default, and you start to see God in ways that other people in your community see God. Another verse that I think is incredibly beautiful when it comes to the gospel belonging to all people is from Acts. It's when Peter has his vision, and it says, "So Peter opened his mouth and said, 'Truly, I understand that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to him.'" The idea that for Peter, who was a Jew, recognizing that the gospel was for all people, was a huge, huge step that he had to overcome. In fact, a little later on, Paul has to rebuke Peter for slipping back into his somewhat racist tendencies and refusing to eat with the Gentiles. But you see that God, Peter has this vision. He understands that God is saying, "Hey, this gospel that I give to you is for all people." Another great passage that we can look at is Ephesians 2. I didn't get into this last week. There's a lot in Ephesians that is just incredibly beautiful. But it says, "For he himself is our peace, who has made us both one and has broken down in his flesh the dividing wall of hostility." And in the passage, it's talking about the hostility between the Jews and the Gentiles. Those who were far away are now near. And it's incredible to see that God calls all people. One of the things I love about a lot of the salvation verses, "Whosoever calleth on the name of the Lord," there are these verses that are inclusive of all people. Not just Jews and not just Gentiles, but as you get into the New Testament, and especially as we get to the book of Revelation, we get to that incredible vision, that multitude beyond number from every tribe, nation, and tongue. We see that God is including all people in his promise of salvation. Let's look at another passage. "Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old has passed away. Behold, the new has come. All this is from God, who through Christ reconciled us to himself and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. This is, of course, talking about the role that we play in winning people over to God, and, of course, the Holy Spirit in us reconciling us back to the Father. But also as we consider our role as God's people, as ambassadors of the gospel, our role is to be reconcilers. I love how Pastor John said this morning, you know, sin has broken down what was whole. Sin has broken down our harmony. It's broken down our unity. And part of redemption, part of restoration in the gospel is that it is built back up again, that the gospel builds that back up again, and we become ambassadors of reconciliation. 2 Corinthians? Right. Okay. Now this was, I think, going back to Ephesians 1. This is one of those the passages that I think you touched on this morning. You know, he made known to us the mystery of his will according to his good pleasure, which he purposed in Christ to be put into effect when the times reach their fulfillment, to bring unity to all things in heaven and on earth under Christ. The idea that God is bringing all things together under Christ and that we get to be a part of that, I think, is a huge part of reconciliation and being a witness of God's unity to the world. I'd like us to take a moment. There's the passage. This passage here is something I'd like you to, if you can turn to the people that you're sitting with. You don't have to get back into your groups. But this passage from John that Jesus says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another just as I have loved you. You also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." If you can just huddle together quickly and ask yourselves, what does this mean? What does this mean to you? What do you think Jesus was talking about? How does this say anything? Does it speak at all into racial reconciliation? Does it speak at all into our cultural differences as a church, as God's global church? So take a few minutes and look at that passage together. Okay. I think we can move forward. Anyone want to share some good stuff? What does love mean? What is this love that Jesus is speaking about? Marilyn. No. What does this love mean? By this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. Great song. Yeah, there's a lot to lose here. So South Africa, just to give you a little bit of a story, South Africa went through the experience of apartheid, which was the basically the idea that different races should be separated from each other. People should be put in specific categories and specific places. Apartheid officially started in 1947 with the National Party, but really it had kind of been in place before that. It really was already there when the British were ruling South Africa as one of their colonies. but it really took a legal effect, a very, very, very specific laws where people of color were not allowed inside of the city limits after 6 o'clock at night. People were not allowed to live in certain places. Certain subjects were removed from people's education. Math and science were taken out of people's education to keep them poor, because uneducated people are easier to control. It was a very strategic, systemic use of racism to better one group of people while crushing another. And the funny thing about the South African story was that the South African government was very openly Christian. In fact, it was really the foundation for why they justified most of what they justified. They were Dutch Reformed in their approach. They had the support of churches around them. And this verse in particular for me was a very hard verse to understand. Especially as a freshman, as a freshman in university in 1995, the first group of students of color who were allowed into the university. Luckily, I studied art, so it was an arts campus, and you know those liberal artists were already way ahead of everyone else in society, so they welcomed us in a way. But I definitely had some bizarre experiences from Christians who would call themselves Christians, who were very theologically conservative, who were very proper and upright and moral. Yet for some reason, this verse was a verse that was easy to skip over. And I think that's oftentimes what happens when we are benefiting from a system or a way of doing things. We start to read the Bible with certain lenses on. And it's really when you start to look at this and even understand it in its context and what the listeners, the zealots, the disciples, what people would have heard when they heard this. Jesus is telling us to love, like that's what's going to win people over. And he was right. The gospel that we have is an incredibly powerful gospel because it's the gospel of love. And I think our witness is compromised when we don't love one another, when we don't seek to understand each other, when we don't seek to be reconcilers of our races and our cultures and our neighborhoods and our communities. And I think this verse for me is particularly challenging. Because it's easy to push people away, even other brothers and sisters who I might not theologically agree with, or they might look different to me. But Jesus says, "There's a lot at stake here. Your witness of me and the power of my love is at stake here." So I know some of this is preaching to the choir because you guys are doing it, and that's what I love about this church is you guys are figuring it out. It's not easy. It's hard. But you're figuring it out. And I'm glad that this is a conversation that you guys are having. There's two things that I love about the passages that we looked at. One of them is the importance and the power of reconciliation. The good news, the gospel doesn't just mean that we're brought near to God. It also means that we're brought near to people we once considered different to ourselves. God restores our relationships with people who have been mistreated. That's reconciliation. The removal of prejudice from our own hearts. The restoration of relationships to a healthy understanding of each other and appreciation of each other. God brings peace where there's once strife and kindness where there's once animosity. I think that God can do this whether we're black, white, Asian, Hispanic. God can bring unity between all people and appreciation for all people. I want to get into another section now that really kind of gives you little pieces of a puzzle as you grow in this idea of racial reconciliation and culture. These little pieces of puzzle are just a bunch of things. This list could have been 100 long, but I chose a few things that I think are helpful in understanding and moving forward in growing about in this topic of racial reconciliation. So the idea of implicit bias, I think you guys did a workshop on this before, also known as implicit social cognition. Implicit bias refers to the attitudes or stereotypes that affect our understanding, actions, and decisions in an unconscious manner. There's a story that Desmond Tutu tells in this book, No Future Without Forgiveness. It's a wonderful book. Archbishop Desmond Tutu he was put in charge of the TRC, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, after apartheid ended and the government realized we have to do something to bring about justice. The end of apartheid was pretty brutal. It was not a peaceful, slow end. A lot of people died. There was a lot of terrorist attacks, freedom fighter attacks, however you want to describe it. A lot of people were killed in their homes, along the streets. And the government basically offered this opportunity for people to come forward and tell the truth about what happened. Maybe someone who was a farm worker on a farm disappeared one day. He never came home, and the boss never told the family what happened to him. People were allowed to come forward and say, actually, this is what happened. This guy did something. I took him into a field, and I shot him, and I buried him in the ground. I mean, the stories were crazy and bizarre. And Desmond Tutu really kind of pioneered this idea that we have to forgive. If we're going to get past this, we have to begin to forgiving each other. And honestly, a lot of the stuff that he's written is just such a beautiful illustration of the truths of the gospel and some of the things that we're touching on here. But in this story, he talks about the power of implicit bias, the programming that he felt. And I'm going to read it to you. It's short and it's interesting, and you might recognize that you have some of these things in yourself. He says, on my first visit to Nigeria, I happened to travel to northern Nigeria in a plane piloted by Nigerians. Coming from South Africa, where blacks did not do such work, I really grew inches with pride in black achievement. The plane took off smoothly. Then we hit turbulence. At one moment, we were at an altitude, and the next, we had left our stomachs up there as the plane shuddered and dropped. I was shocked at what I discovered. I found I was saying to myself, I really am bothered that there is no white man in the cockpit. Can these blacks manage to navigate us out of this horrible experience? It was all involuntary and spontaneous. I would never have believed that I had, in fact, been so radically brainwashed. I would have denied it vigorously because I prided myself on being an exponent of black consciousness. But in a crisis, something deeper had emerged. I had accepted a white definition of existence, that whites were somehow superior to and more competent than blacks. Of course, those black pilots were able to land the plane quite competently. That idea of implicit bias that lurks inside of us, that somehow was shaped inside of us, is something that we need to examine and we need to look at. And as we get into the applications, I'll give you some ideas of how to go about that. Meta perceptions. This is the idea of meta perceptions are defined as judgments made by the self about what others think about the self. What I think you think of me. Can you follow that? What I think you think of me. This is something that oftentimes has hurt people with nothing going on. You know, it's I was explaining this to my wife If you've seen the movie Juno, there's a girl who has a locker down the school hallway, and she gives kind of this like crazy stink eye look, and one of the girls says, "I don't think she likes me," and they're like, "No, that's just how her face is," you know. It's the idea that I think this person thinks this about me, and sometimes that can be a real trap for people. Without clarifying, without understanding, what does this person really think about me? Allowing those invisible seeds to be planted in our hearts, I think, can be very dangerous. And I've especially seen this be a struggle for people of color who oftentimes don't really know what someone else thinks about them, but we absorb an untruth into our hearts. And we all know that the devil is an accuser of the brethren, and that's what he does. He says things that are untrue. So those meta perceptions are things that people need to examine and address. Diversity, again, I feel like, you know, I'm preaching to the choir with you guys as you're seeking to do this. The thing about diversity, people are comforted by commonality, but they really grow from diversity. It's easy to be with people who are like you. We all know this to be true, except for at Thanksgiving, right? That can be a little stressful. But the idea of being with people, and I think that's one of the reasons I put the question in there before about, you know, when were you not a minority and how did you feel? And I could hear a few people saying, I honestly feel comfortable. I felt like I didn't have to be on, you know. Diversity is a difficult thing. It's hard to sing a song in another language, you know. I like my songs, you know. But diversity is something that we strive to if we have this bigger vision of being the united body of Christ. And along with diversity comes the idea of false diversity. And false diversity oftentimes finds itself lurking in institutions and places where people are okay with things just looking and appearing a certain way. The idea of tokenism, having someone to, you know, represent, to meet quotas or to be able to say that we are a diverse group of people. Things like that are really a false sense of diversity. Assimilation is really someone fitting into an already existing culture. Assimilation is something that oftentimes here a minority person has to do just because that's the way it is. You know, if you're in a class or in a group or in a church even, you know, assimilating and fitting in is really part of surviving even. But it's not really true diversity if the person is not able to express their own culture and their own voice and their own opinion. And representation, this is something that often happens to people when they are a minority. I think even my wife found this to be true when she was in South Africa, where people would say, "So do Americans do this?" And you're like, "Which Americans? Texans? Michiganders?" Like, you know. And the idea of trying to represent your entire race is a very difficult thing to put on somebody. And nobody really likes to do that. People do. People like to help and explain, you know, in China, this is how my family does it. But they're not saying that all people in China do it this way. And so being aware that when you're asking someone a question, you know, you're asking them to represent a microcosm of a bigger, you know, people group.